Across the Pacifica network and over 50 community stations around the country, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, December 4, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandes. Week one of the UN weapons inspections in Iraq draws to a close, with very little being found. The US is still clamoring for war and drawing Turkey into its plans. The Supreme Court today begins looking at the Miranda ruling. And we go to India in our special series looking at HIV/AIDS. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments this morning over whether so-called pro-life protesters can be prosecuted under federal racketeering laws. Josh Chaffin reports from D.C.
The High Court heard the appeal of anti-abortion protesters who object to being sued under the racketeering law known as RICO. Members of an association called the Pro-Life Action Network, or PLAN, say their protests are an expression of free speech. Four states and the animal rights group PETA agree with that position, comparing PLAN's actions to disobedience practiced by civil rights groups in the 1960s. Faye Clayton, a lawyer for the National Organization for Women, says the comparison is inaccurate.
I think it was Justice Souter that commented that the sit-ins at the lunch counters were, for the most part, orderly. They did not use force. They tried to use persuasion. They didn't use intimidation.
Clayton says the PLAN protesters' sometimes violent tactics aren't protected by the Constitution. PLAN members have been fined for beatings, blocking clinic doors, harassing abortion doctors, and destroying property. The High Court should have a decision in the case before next summer. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington, D.C.
The Russian government lost its bid to have a top Chechen politician extradited from Denmark. The Danish Ministry of Justice decided this week that material provided by the Russian government as a basis for their request for extradition is not sufficient for the Danish court. From Copenhagen, Patrick Beckett reports.
Ahmed Zakayev was released Tuesday after being held 5 weeks in a Danish jail. Zakayev was arrested by Danish police several days after the Moscow hostage crisis, which Russian officials said he played a role in organizing. Zakayev is now free to remain in Denmark or leave the country as he wishes. At a press conference, Zakayev, who is the vice prime minister of Chechnya, renewed his commitment to a peaceful solution to the conflict between Russia and Chechnya.
But today there's actually a hope that our request for a peaceful solution and our declarations that we are ready to start going away from armed fight and change to political negotiations. That is really a hope that exists today.
But Russian officials have accused Denmark of failing to comply with international standards on terrorism. They say they will continue to seek Zakayev's arrest. From Copenhagen, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Patrick Beckett.
In what could become one of the nation's largest legal challenges to the Bush administration's assault on Muslim immigrants, lawyers in Seattle have filed a class action suit to block all U.S. deportations to Somalia. Martha Baskin has more from Seattle.
The lawsuit contends that deportation violates immigration and naturalization statutes because Somalia does not have a functioning government and therefore cannot accept deportees. Lawyers also argue that the practice violates customary facts of international law, including the Refugee Convention, Convention Against Torture, and the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights. Ann Benson, directing attorney for the Washington Defender Association's Immigration Project.
I think that the importance of legal advocacy and lawsuits and pushing for the rule of law has never been more crucial and more important to be fighting for than it is right now.
INS officials contend that the policy is lawful because there is no requirement for travel documents for Somalis to enter the country and deportees are not rejected. To date, a federal judge in Seattle issued a temporary restraining order preventing the INS from deporting 5 Somalis. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
The superintendent of schools for Madison, Wisconsin, canceled an anti-war teach-in yesterday because the forum didn't include pro-war voices. John Hamilton reports from Madison.
The cancellation came in response to a barrage of pressure generated by a local right-wing talk radio program. Organizers say they faced harassment from other students and that posters advertising the teach-in were repeatedly torn down. The cancellation came on the same day that Madison residents learned that the schools must turn over the names and phone numbers of all high school students to military recruiters. It's a little-known provision in George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind education bill, and failure to comply with the order could cost the school district $7 million in federal funding. Matt Rothschild is editor of the Madison-based Progressive magazine and one of three panelists who were barred from yesterday's teach-in.
I mean, at a time when the military recruiters can now prey upon high school students in Madison and around the country, then to bar the door to a teach-in seems to be a very chilling thing indeed. I mean, we've gone far down that slippery slope.
The teach-in has been tentatively rescheduled for December 13th. Organizers say they'll comply with the order and invite Hawks to participate. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm John Hamilton in Madison, Wisconsin.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The UN inspectors made their deepest penetration into the Iraqi hinterland this morning.
United Nations arms inspectors wrapped up their first week of inspections today. They searched a nuclear...
The United States is pressing the UN to carry out inspections more aggressively.
The first week of UN weapons inspections in Iraq has been described by some as a media circus, especially in the United States. Journalists have followed the weapons inspectors around, and most news networks in this country have been leading their newscasts with blow-by-blow descriptions of what the inspectors are or are not finding. Dennis Halliday, former Assistant Secretary General of the UN, says weapons inspectors have so far found little.
This first week, I think, has been largely a PR week. They haven't opened up any new space. They're not on the ground in any number. They can't really do a serious job. So I think it doesn't really matter, and I think it shows to American viewers that the UN and the BLICS endeavor is serious. But when you look at the task and you look at the numbers and you look at the game plan of Washington, it just doesn't add up to a serious endeavor, and I think we've got to take a different approach.
Yesterday, Donald Rumsfeld remained defiant that the Iraqi government was concealing weapons of mass destruction, saying Iraq is guilty until it proves itself innocent.
If the responsibility is on Iraq to demonstrate that it does not have weapons of mass destruction under the UN resolution, it is not for some country to go in and give them a clean bill of health. It is for Iraq to give itself a clean bill of health by saying, here's honestly what we currently have, here's where it is, here's what we've done, please destroy it for us.
Halliday says Rumsfeld's comments directly indicate that Washington is not interested in protecting world security as they claim.
It's very difficult to prove what you do not have. And therefore, I think they're over the barrel yet again. The sanctions continue, the bombing attacks by the U.S. continue, and I don't think they're ever going to be able to satisfy Washington, because I think, as Washington has quite honestly said, they want regime change. They're not interested in weapons of mass destruction in as much as a new system in Iraq that would be friendly to the United States.
Meanwhile, U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz met yesterday with the new Turkish government during a visit to Turkey to secure backing for a U.S. attack on Iraq. He signaled Washington is looking to spend up to hundreds of millions of dollars to upgrade Turkish bases that could be used in a war against Iraq. The use of Turkish bases would give the United States the chance to send warplanes or soldiers to attack from the north of Iraq.
We reached agreement on the next steps in military planning and preparations, and I believe we've charted a course for the way forward, working together. So now it should be clearer than ever that Saddam Hussein is surrounded by the international community.
Turkey's foreign minister said yesterday his country would allow the United States to use military bases in the country for a strike against Iraq, but his ministry later said his comments were not a firm commitment by Turkey, and the use of Turkish bases was only certain if the U.S. attack had U.N. approval. Until this week, Turkey has been opposed to military intervention in Iraq. This past weekend, 25,000 protesters took to the streets of Turkey to tell their government that their country was too poor to support the U.S. military action against Iraq. Wolfowitz has asked Turkey to contribute as many as 40,000 soldiers to the possible attack. Besides the Wolfowitz trip, visits will also be made to other countries in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East by senior Bush administration officials to secure support for an attack on Iraq. Secretary of State Colin Powell is in Colombia, where today he met with Colombian President Alvaro Uribe, but few details were disclosed of what the two discussed. Yesterday, Powell told reporters that he's looking for ways to provide additional help to Colombia as it confronts, quote, narco-traffickers and narco-terrorists. He said the Bush administration plans to increase monetary support to Colombia to $500 million from the current $300 million. The funds will be earmarked for training and equipment. Powell also said the U.S. still wants paramilitary men accused of narcotics trafficking to be extradited to the U.S. This is last Friday, the right-wing United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, the AUC, more commonly known as the paramilitaries, released a communique declaring a two-month ceasefire. The U.S. has not officially responded to the Colombian government's possible talks with the illegal armed group, who appear on the U.S. list of terrorists. But Powell is expected to address the issue this week. In Bogotá, Nicole Carson has more.
Last Friday, the day the AUC's initiative hit the newswire, some 300 women, representing unions, campesinos, indigenous and black women's groups from across the country, filled the halls of Colombia's Congress with song, saying no to war and yes to peace. A member of this women's coalition, who was displaced by the AUC 2 years ago and who for security reasons cannot give her name, says she wants dialogues between the government and armed actors. But she says she does not trust the sincerity of this new development between the AUC and the government.
This is a false peace. In front of the cameras, they are saying they're going to dialogue and they are going to stop bullets. But in the communities, they are saying the contrary. At least in the zones where I live, they say, in December, they are going to conduct a witch hunt and kill everyone who was displaced and who returns home to visit their families.
A week ago, the press reported that the Colombian government recently held 5 secret meetings with AUC leaders to discuss conditions for talks. In their 12-point proposal, the AUC asked that their leaders be granted amnesty for their crimes. Representative of Congress Gustavo Petro says that the AUC's function is as the world's main exporters of cocaine. Petro says that the AUC are also the main violators of human rights in Colombia, and that a ceasefire is a farce because the Colombian armed forces and the AUC have mostly worked as partners.
Por eso cuando se habla de un cese de hostilidades, uno dice, ¿pero de cuál? Si nunca se ha observado en la historia del país conflictos armados entre los paramilitares y el Estado.
So when they speak of ceasing hostilities and one asks, but which, if in the country's history there has ever been armed conflicts between the paramilitaries and the state, they've permitted them and many times they've helped construct them and protect them. In this measure, the ceasefire is artificial. The paramilitaries have attacked the civilian populations through assassinations and massacres.
According to the Permanent Committee to Defend Human Rights, the AUC is responsible for an estimated 83% of political violence and the guerrilla groups 12%. The magazine Semana reported AUC leader Salvatore Mancuso, who was indicted by the U.S. along with Castaño for bringing more than 17 tons of cocaine into the U.S. and Europe over the last 5 years, recently lunched with some congressmen in Bogotá and explained that he and Castaño would not submit to U.S. justice. He allegedly asked the legislators for their help in finding a legal means to grant them amnesty for their crimes. Senator Carlos Gaviria, former magistrate of Colombia's Constitutional Court, says he favors changing legislation to revoke the obstacle of political status that impedes talks between the AUC and the government. But he does not believe leaders of the AUC should be pardoned for their crimes.
I have always believed that peace cannot be built on basis of impunity. We have to pay a high price for peace, but not any price.
In Bush's Homeland Security bill, it authorizes funds for the Colombian government to combat guerrilla and paramilitary groups, quote, to take measures to protect the health and human welfare in circumstances of emergency, including kidnapping, end quote. Colin Powell is required to inform Congress on President Uribe's efforts to combat drug trafficking and respect human rights. In Bogota, I'm Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. The Supreme Court takes up a case today that challenges the Miranda ruling, which protects suspects against self-incrimination. The case centers on Oliverio Martinez, a California farm worker left blind and paralyzed by a police shooting and then interrogated without notice of his legal rights. If the court sides against Martinez, police may no longer be required to advise suspects that they have the right to remain silent. Justin Stinchcomb reports from Los Angeles.
In 1997, police in the town of Oxnard, northwest of Los Angeles, stopped farm worker Oliverio Martinez as he passed through a vacant lot where they were questioning a man suspected of selling drugs. Officer Andrew Salinas searched Martinez and found a knife in his waistband. Martinez panicked and ran, but Salinas tackled him. Police say that as the two struggled, the farm worker tried to grab Salinas's gun. He later confessed that he did so out of fear the gun would be used against him. Salinas's partner, Maria Pena, opened fire, shooting Martinez 5 times in the spine, eye, and legs. Under the 1996 Miranda ruling, police must inform those held for questioning of their right to remain silent. Confessions obtained without such warnings can't be used in court. Lori Levinson of Loyola Marymount University.
In this case, really the question is whether police can force a confession out of somebody and not be sued for it.
As Martinez lapsed in and out of consciousness at the hospital, patrol supervisor Ben Chavez demanded that the farm worker tell him what had happened. He continued, even when Martinez said he didn't want to talk anymore and begged for medical treatment. Chavez never advised Martinez he had a legal right not to talk. Martinez sued Chavez, saying his constitutional rights had been violated and that his confession could not be used as evidence against him. The Criminal Justice Legal Foundation has weighed in on Chavez's side. Charles Hobson of the foundation says he favors limitations on Miranda, but that's not what's at stake in this case. He says Miranda has never been used to create civil liability for police officers, only to disqualify coerced confessions from use in court.
The Miranda rule has never been held to do what the Ninth Circuit allowed it in this case and what Martinez is claiming. I personally think that the Miranda rule extends too far, but this doesn't involve scaling back Miranda. It's just basically holding Miranda to where it's always been.
But last year, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with Martinez. Officer Chavez appealed that decision to the Supreme Court, saying that because Martinez was never charged with a crime, he had no Miranda rights. The Bush administration has taken Chavez's side as well. Solicitor General Theodore Olson argues in a Friend of the Court brief that if no use is made of a compelled statement, no violation of the Fifth Amendment has been committed. University of Southern California law professor Erwin Chemerinsky says the Bush administration wants to weaken Miranda in order to question alleged terrorists without restrictions.
Part of the motivation, I think, is that the Bush administration thinks that they can then engage in whatever questioning they want of suspected terrorists, however coercive they want to make it, without having to give Miranda warnings, so long as they don't want to use the statements that are gained from the questioning at trial. There is no evidence whatsoever that complying with the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination handcuffs the police or impedes effective investigation and prosecution of terrorists.
Opponents of the government's position say a court decision against Martinez would represent another sacrifice of civil liberties in the name of the war on terrorism. Oliverio Martinez, blind and paralyzed, now lives in a one-room trailer with his father in Oxnard. For Free Speech Radio News in Los Angeles, I'm Justin Stinchcomb.
Texas is scheduled to execute Leonard Rojas Wednesday night, a death row prisoner with familiar claims of inadequate defense by state-appointed defense attorneys. As Rojas' current attorney works on last-minute appeals for a stay of execution, a report has been released by the Texas Defender Service detailing how state-appointed attorneys are failing to present critical evidence in at least a third of death row cases. From Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas, Renee Feltz looks at the pending execution in the context of the new report. In 1994, Leonard Rojas shot and killed his wife and brother out of anger that the two were sleeping together behind his back. Rojas confessed to the murder, was convicted in capital proceedings, and sentenced to death. As he awaits his execution Wednesday, his current attorney is raising concerns about the lawyer the state of Texas provided to defend Rojas during the habeas stage of his appeals process. Habeas proceedings are the last point in a prisoner's case when new claims of innocence, trial misconduct, or ineffective counsel can be raised. Rojas's habeas attorney had never before represented a death row inmate, three times had his license placed on probated suspension, and was diagnosed with a mental disorder that affected his legal work, including his work on the Rojas case. Rojas's current attorney, Greg Weirchuk.
There was no investigation done about whether he received effective assistance of counsel, whether the prosecution may have suppressed favorable evidence that could have helped Leonard Rojas either at the guilt phase of the trial or the punishment phase, and never investigated or interviewed witnesses or jurors to determine whether, you know, there may have been some juror misconduct, such as flipping a coin to decide the verdict. And there wasn't any investigation into potential mitigating evidence that could have been presented to convince the jurors to give a life sentence instead of a death sentence.
Concerns raised about the habeas attorney in Rojas's case are not unique. According to a report released earlier this week by the Texas Defender Service called Lethal Indifference, a high number of death row inmates are being propelled through the state habeas court proceedings with unqualified, irresponsible, or overburdened attorneys. The report examined hundreds of cases since 1995 when the state began allowing new claims of innocence to be raised through habeas. Executive Director of the Texas Defender Service, Jim Marcus.
When you file a petition that has no new evidence attached to it, you have filed, in effect, a blank piece of paper. We found that this was happening in 39% of the cases, and that's just a staggering number.
Under state law, state-appointed habeas counsel must file a motion in federal court 15 days after all state court proceedings are exhausted. Rojas's attorney failed to file this motion. Jim Marcus discusses this failure in light of the Defender Service report.
The court has seen lawyers repeatedly fail to file cognizable claims and has done nothing to protect the rights of death row prisoners to a full and fair review of their case.
The Court of Criminal Appeals, a court mandated by a state statute to ensure attorneys file timely motions, rejected yesterday appeals that the state failed to provide Rojas full access to the courts. State Governor Rick Perry's counsel is now considering a clemency request that rests upon whether or not Rojas's rights in this area were protected. Rojas is currently scheduled to be put to death by lethal injection at 6 p.m. Wednesday night. In Houston, Texas, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
There are now over 40 million people living with HIV or AIDS, according to the UN and the World Health Organization's latest findings. For the first time in the epidemic's history, the number of women living with HIV has risen to half of the global total. India now has the second largest number of people living with HIV/AIDS, second only to South Africa. Nearly 4 million Indians are already infected with HIV or AIDS, and infections are rising at alarming rates. But India has been slow to respond to the crisis, as Miranda Kennedy reports from Delhi in this, the third of our week-long special AIDS investigation.
AIDS is ravaging across India, and no one seems to know how to stop it. That's the feeling among doctors, AIDS workers, and patients in this, the country the UN names as the second worst hit by the epidemic. Treatment is scarce, and costs are prohibitive for those already diagnosed. HIV in India has already spread beyond high-risk populations of sex workers and drug users and into the workplace and family. Akhila Sivadas works closely with UNAIDS to monitor the rise of AIDS in India.
The epidemic has gone rural. The epidemic has filtered into the generalized population. And one group that is immensely impacted has been the women. There's already evidence in places like Andhra Pradesh of as much as 11% of women who are coming for antenatal care are now affected by HIV. We are entering a very critical phase as far as women are concerned. It's a do or die situation for them.
Awareness of HIV is lowest among women and in rural areas. Women increasingly contract the disease from their migrant laborer husbands who spend much of the year in cities. Increasingly, wives whose husbands have died without even knowing they had AIDS are finding out they are infected. Sheila is from a village in Bengal. She found out she was HIV positive several months ago when she was working as a maid in Delhi. She was infected by her husband, who used to visit prostitutes. She does not know if he is alive or dead. When Sheila's employers found out she had HIV, they refused to employ her any longer. Since then, she has lived in Sahara, a privately run holistic care center in Delhi. Sahara began as a drug rehab center, but when AIDS first hit India in the early 90s, they were overwhelmed with infected drug users. Now they provide basic nursing care and nutrition classes for HIV patients. Over half of the staff is HIV positive. But hospices like Sahara are few and far between. Discrimination and stigma plague treatment of AIDS patients in India. Sunil Batra is a High Court lawyer who has brought dozens of cases against government hospitals for refusing to treat HIV-positive patients.
On the one hand, the government policy states that if we set up separate wards for HIV/AIDS, that itself is encouraging discrimination. So they should be put in the general wards along with the other patients. But then what happens is, in practice, when a HIV/AIDS patient is taken to a government hospital, when they know his status, the doctor in charge of admission writes, "There's no room."
Stories abound of HIV-positive people knocking on door after hospital door for treatment for a minor injury. So do tales of the homeless and orphaned AIDS victims, with no AIDS wards to turn to. But last week, the health ministry said it would focus on prevention and awareness rather than treatment. Dr. Neville, founder and director of the Sahara Hospice, is only too accustomed to apathy and neglect when it comes to the government dealing with AIDS.
I think one day when millions get wiped out suddenly, that's when they're going to take notice, and maybe then things will improve. But we need some radical change. It's a hopeless situation, because we know there's lots of money available. Prevention and awareness is cool, but how much more are you going to do? I mean, we've been doing it for 10 years now.
India's government has set up just over 300 HIV testing sites around the country, which many say cannot possibly supervise India's AIDS population. India's National AIDS Control Organization now warns that over 10 million people could be HIV positive by 2010. But on Sunday, Sahara's HIV-positive patients held a festival to celebrate World AIDS Day. Their message for the Indian government, "We are anything but dead." Ricky Lombi works with the Delhi Network of Positive People.
Let us all join together in fighting against AIDS, not the people who are infected. Help us to fight and help us to celebrate our life.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in Delhi.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Katza Mester with production assistance from Scott Gurian. Headlines editor is Randy Zimmerman and Jade Paget-Seekins is our technical producer. We have technical assistance from Pauline Bartolone, web support from Vanessa Tate, and our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Chelli, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez and William Perdomo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.